Hello, everyone, and welcome to Outlook Live, the Federal Reserve System's audio conference series on consumer compliance topics. My name is Tracy Bassinger, and I'm with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. It is my pleasure to be opening today's webinar on real estate-owned disposition risks and CRA opportunities. We're fortunate to have a panel of speakers today that can speak to a wide range of both risks and opportunities associated with REO properties. I'll begin the event today by turning things over to Joseph Fershine, Deputy Associate Director for Community Development at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and Joseph will introduce the remainder of our panel. But before I hand things over, I want to say just a few words about the event and mention some administrative and logistical details. This Outlook Live session is delivered using a webinar format. You should be receiving both the audio and the video via your computer. If you're experiencing any technical difficulties, you may access troubleshooting information through the login screen. With the webinar format, we will be advancing the presentation slides during the event. However, copies of the presentation are also available for downloading at our website, consumercomplianceoutlook.org. In conjunction with the Outlook Live webinars, the Federal Reserve System also publishes a quarterly newsletter titled Consumer Compliance Outlook, which is also available at the Consumer Compliance website. If you subscribe to the Outlook newsletter electronically, you will automatically be notified of future Outlook Live webinars and also receive notice when the new issue of the newsletter is released. Both programs are part of the Federal Reserve System's outreach activities and are free of charge. In addition, webcasts and audio feeds, including today's presentation, are archived and available for playback. The format today is for the panel discussion to last a little over an hour, leaving us somewhere between 20 and 30 minutes for a Q&A session. We've received a few questions prior to today's presentation, and at any time during the event, you may also use the online chat feature to submit additional questions. We'll do our best to cover as many of the questions as possible, but please understand that we may not be able to get to all of them. Also, if you're unable to stay with us for the entire time, you may access the presentation and audio feed at a later time by visiting our website. That wraps up my introductory comments, so with that, Joseph, I'll turn things over to you.
Great. Thanks, Tracy. And as Tracy said, my name is Joseph Fershine, and I'm the Deputy Associate Director here at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And I'm going to just take a few minutes to introduce our panel and describe the purpose of the event, and then I'll turn it over to Jim Park, who's going to be moderating our discussion. So as you can see from the first slide, it lists the various participants. Jim Park is the former chair of the board's Community Consumer Advisory Council. And then I'm joined by my colleague at the Cleveland Fed, Barbara Bilardo. She's a banking supervisor there. And then in addition, we have a number of external panelists, Brian Hurley, who's the president and COO of New Vista Asset Management, P.J. McCarthy, who's a director in the REO Alternative Disposition at Fannie Mae, Yves Montbleur, who's director of seller relationships at the National Community Stabilization Trust, and Tyler Smith, who's REO manager in the REO Community Development Premier Asset Services Group at Wells Fargo Bank. So if you go to slide two, I'll just say a word about the purpose of today's session. As the first bullet indicates, it will come up shortly, the purpose of the session is really to provide information to institutions on potential risks resulting from inadequate REO management practices, and also to introduce some promising practices that folks may not be aware of. At the very end of this presentation, we're going to provide a slide that lists some resources that you may want to look at for more information. One of the resources that's listed there is a speech by Federal Reserve Governor Betsy Duke that she gave at September 1st here at the board. And I just wanted to highlight just a few things from those remarks because I thought you would find it useful. The first is that an estimated 1 million or more properties will likely pass through REO inventory in 2011, with another million or so per year expected in both 2012 and 2013. And while the numbers are difficult to measure precisely, we estimate that in the second quarter of 2011, roughly 500,000 to 600,000 of the 2 million vacant homes for sale in the U.S. were REO properties. The only last thing I'll end with is a quote that Governor Duke had in her speech that I think is relevant to today and really goes to the purpose of today's session. Governor Duke said, there are steps that all REO holders can take today to ensure that they are not contributing further to the problems. They can and should make sure that they are adequately monitoring any third-party vendors with which they contract to maintain, market, or sell REO properties. Certainly, the recent interagency review of servicers revealed the severe consequences that can result from failing to monitor third-party vendors. Before converting REO properties to rental, REO holders could also consider first look types of programs to enable owner-occupants, public entities, and nonprofits windows of time to bid on available properties. A number of institutions have used such programs with successful results. And REO holders who sell large numbers of properties to investors should consider processes such as those used by the GSEs to screen and monitor bulk investors to reasonably assess their probable actions regarding maintenance and disposition after acquiring the properties. So that gives you a flavor for sort of why we're doing this, and I'm going to quickly turn it over to Jim Park, who's going to basically begin the discussion to address what some of the risks are of REO, as well as what some of the promising practices are from our panel of external REO experts. So, Jim, the floor is yours.
Joseph, thank you so much. And I would like to thank the Federal Reserve and the regional banks for really embracing this issue, because it is such a critical issue that impacts institutions, but neighborhoods and individuals throughout the country. And as Joseph mentioned, the magnitude of the problem is significant. And the work that we do, the policy we put in place, can have either a detrimental or a positive impact in our recovery process. And so I applaud all of you for being a part of this discussion today. REOs clearly today are having a negative impact on the gains we made as a country and as a community in terms of getting more owner-occupied individuals into homes. And so the work that we do, the policies that we talk about, can have the positive or the negative impact we discussed earlier. What we want to do is to spend some time with all of you, kind of getting some thoughts and ideas from some of these experts that we have on the panel. And what I'd like to do is just jump right into the program and to have our first topic of discussion, which is the property preservation and maintenance issue. And I want to start with Yves, if I may. Yves, you've done a lot of work with community groups, cities, and nonprofits in trying to restore neighborhoods that have been impacted hard by the foreclosure crisis. Let me ask you, why is the property preservation and maintenance of REO so important to stabilizing communities?
Jim, I want to say first thank you to the Federal Reserve for putting this together. I think it's very important. Really, to answer this question, the nonprofits and cities, just like people, they want to purchase in areas that are desirable. The failure to preserve properties and the failure to maintain the properties, they have a perilous effect on the communities, and it creates an attractive nuisance. Neglected properties are advertisements for trouble. Really, when a property is neglected, it says, come and squat over here because my owners don't care. I'm vacant and I'm not boarded, so come and strip what little value is left in me. This is not the type of communication the servicers want going to public. Deferred maintenance only adds to the overall rehab cost for the groups that are already in a very, very tight budget. So it's critical that ongoing property preservation is maintained by anyone who owns properties after foreclosure.
Great. Let me ask from both a outsourcer vendor perspective as well as an institution that holds these assets. Let me start with Brian Hurley, President and COO from Nuvis Asset Management. From your point of view, what types of property preservation and repair strategy leads to the best community and institutional outcomes?
Thank you, Jim, and thanks to the Federal Reserve. I think repair strategies for REOs have both a primary and a secondary impact. So it seems pretty obvious that repaired properties present better to the marketplace overall. They elevate or at least sustain property values and therefore benefit the surrounding neighbors, as Yves suggested. But, you know, in terms of institutional results, many lenders look at investments in repairs, investments in rehabilitation, refurbishment, in terms of a calculated return. In other words, if they invest a dollar in repair, are they going to get a dollar back? Are they going to get $2 back? Are they going to get 50 cents back in terms of their investment? And I think that's a fair calculus, but there's another secondary factor to consider in terms of the importance of repair investments on both an institution's recovery and also on some of the community and owner occupancy issues that you raised. By repairing properties, lenders actually broaden the market to which their assets are exposed. In other words, with properties properties have significant structural defects or repair challenges, they're really only accessible to investors who can fund the acquisition with cash. But when lenders actually fund the repair of these properties, they actually open up the marketplace and allow owner-occupants to actually purchase these properties as well. And that obviously has, you know, some long-term benefits for communities and neighborhoods, but there's also an institutional performance impact as well. So at NuVista, we've actually studied REO performance, REO disposition in 21 of the hardest-hit communities in the United States since the first quarter of 2009. And if you actually look at final REO price differences by buyer type, at least for the last four quarters, it's been consistently true that owner-occupant purchase prices are about 41% higher than non-owner-occupant purchase prices. Now, that's obviously not an apples-to-apples comparison. In other words, it's not simply a sign that if you invest in repairs, you automatically get a higher sales price. But the gap in that 41% is at least partially attributable to repair investments that lead both to better community outcomes and also to better returns with respect to institutions.
That's terrific. Thanks for that explanation. TJ, from Fannie Mae, as the largest holder of REO assets in the country, obviously you have a tremendous impact on the outcome at a community level, and I know you have done a lot of work to help stabilize neighborhoods. Do you, as Brian mentioned earlier, sort of these repair strategies and maintenance strategies, what are the best practices you have deployed into the marketplace to ensure the kinds of outcome that Brian had just mentioned?
Sure. Thanks, Jim, and thanks as well to the Federal Reserve. I think Brian did a great job alluding to how we view repairs, and repairs are really one of the primary pieces to our neighborhood stabilization strategy. Just to give you a sense of the scale, we repaired over 87,000 properties in 2010, and just to give you the relative number, we disposed of 186,000 properties in 2010. So we're repairing very heavily, like Brian referenced. Generally, when you make repairs, you enhance the ability for an owner or for a buyer to finance that property. You increase the marketability of that property, and in general, you can see a multiple return on your investment in those repairs. But that doesn't mean that we won't make a repair where we won't see a multiple return on it. But at the same time, we obviously we view the market. We make assessments of the property. We make assessments of the market, and that's how we make our repair decisions. But we are we're very focused on where we can drive owner occupancy with repairs, and where we can always be a good neighbor by at least bringing properties back to the standards of the neighborhood. And on the property preservation piece, I'd say our focus there has primarily been on making sure that we have the right resources. And a couple years ago, we went from two property preservation companies to four. We feel like we've got very good coverage. We do a lot of auditing of our own vendors to make sure that the work's being done well, but we also like to hear back from the folks on the ground. The best eyes and ears are the folks in the local market, so we also have an 800 number, 1-800-7-FANNIE, that we take feedback in. So we're very focused on property preservation as well, because it's our asset. It's best for the community. It's best for the taxpayer if we can protect that asset and move it back into the market.
PJ, have you seen any kind of correlation between your repair strategy and meeting kind of local ordinance? I know that's an issue that all holders of assets, REO assets, are facing out there in the marketplace. Have you seen any connection between those two?
Absolutely. I mean, we obviously respond to all local ordinances and code violations or that sort of thing with repairs, but we also are working, I guess, proactively, you'd say, with code enforcement officials, and I think a few of our property preservation companies are very good at this, understanding what changes are being made in local ordinances so that we can stay ahead of that curve and work proactively with code enforcement officials to make sure that, you know, we're being the good neighbor and we're aware of the issues that they're dealing with on the ground.
Thank you. Let me shift to the next question, if I may. You know, what type of challenges do you face when REOs have illegal conversions or have significant structural damages that makes repairs very difficult? If you have those situations, is it still possible to make repairs to the property and make it available for owner-occupants? Let me start with Brian with Wells Fargo PAS.
This is Tyler with Wells Fargo.
That's all right.
Not a problem. And again, thanks everyone for allowing us a seat at the table today. I would say the biggest challenge that we face with illegal conversions are on occupied REO properties. Nearly half of the REO properties that we get in our inventory remain occupied either by tenant occupants or by the former mortgager, oftentimes less than cooperative in allowing us access or entry into the property to make necessary repairs. So that creates some concerns when we know there's violations on the property and it's still occupied and we're not allowed to get into it to correct or cure the violations. We've made a lot of headway with our agent network, just educating them on the tenant or occupant's rights, how to approach those occupants, and let them know that we're there in a separate capacity than what they're probably expecting. We're not there just to kick them out of the house. First thing we've got to do is fix the house. Then we can address how to get them to vacate the property legally and appropriately. Once the property is vacated, then we'll look at each property on its own merits. We'll consider the as-is value of the property. We consider the neighborhood conditions, the marketability. We will consider demolition if that's the only viable strategy for safekeeping that neighborhood. We also have a significant donation program, so we'll offer it up to our nonprofit partners to see if it's a home that they're interested in obtaining for free, and then putting the rehab dollars in and hopefully putting a new low or moderate income family into the home. So all of those things are considered on a case-by-case basis. And the other thing that factors in is the client authority. So we service for, you know, a number of different investors, and what their delegated authority to us is will often dictate what strategy we can take.
Well, first, apologize, Tyler. I just gave Brian two jobs, apparently. But if I may now shift to Eves, in this, with the same question, you've seen illegal conversion of these sort of properties with major structural issues and so on. From a community perspective, you deal with a lot of nonprofits and community groups. What do you look for in that regard?
Well, our 300-plus buyers, they have to follow code and necessarily remove all illegal add-ons. Frankly, this just means that the cost of rehab increases. Unlike the traditional buyers who may do nothing with a garage conversion, and when I say a garage conversion, simply where a bedroom unit has been placed in the garage with nothing else done, and then the new prospective buyer can advertise it as an additional bedroom. Our buyers can't do that, so they have to bring it to code, and that's going to cost more money on their part as well. One of the core challenges, though, in dealing with properties that have significant structural damage is convincing some of our servicing partners to really donate the property to our buyers, or take the money that will be going towards the demolition and use that as a contribution for our buyers. Our buyers, because they are community-based, we know exactly what they plan on doing with those properties. It's simply doing the rehab, bringing them to code, and then sell them to a low or moderate income person. Whereas when an investor purchases the property, who, by the way, does not shed any insight on what will be done with it, it's just a big question mark. So whenever we want to move a property for a donation that has significant damages, it'd be great if we could get some of our, more of our sellers involved in providing cash towards the acquisition, especially when it will have been going towards a demolition.
Great. And do you see that a number of the institutions are beginning to do that, support you financially as well as providing the donation?
Yes, we've made significant strides. Historically, the trust wasn't really involved in the donation platform, but now we've become more engaged to meet the needs of our community buyers. And a lot of the servicer partners, they're providing assistance by making those lists available to us. And because we have so many people, we'll reach out to the various community persons and let them know what properties may be available and try to facilitate an easy transaction for the donees.
Right. You know, earlier, I think Tyler mentioned some of the local ordinance issues and so on. I know this is a big topic in communities throughout the country, and ordinances obviously depend on your jurisdiction. Can you give me some example, Tyler, of sort of the ordinance issues, local ordinance issues, and how you stay on top of that from an institution that manages properties throughout the country? You know, give us some examples of mandates. How do you educate your vendors, your employees, to ensure that everyone's in compliance?
Well, we rely on our property preservation departments. We've got a whole department that keeps on top of local ordinances with respect to prop pres. So they handle the preservation of the property in compliance with ordinances prior to foreclosure, and then once the foreclosure sale is completed, they'll hand that property off to the REO department, which is Premier Asset Services. We also rely heavily on our agent network. You're right. It's very confusing. It's very fluid. There's a number of different ordinances that seem to contradict each other. And so we often have to consult with our legal department on the best course of action. But really, the easiest way to summarize it and what we tell our asset managers is just do the right thing. It will never come back to us if a property is too secured. If we demo a property without our investor or client approval, but we know it was the right thing to do, then that's fine. We're willing to take that hit just so that we don't incur the reputational risks that could be associated with that type of property.
You know, you have obviously, and many of the folks on this call have a large volume of inventory that they manage. So you see ordinance issues come up over and over again, so you know how to prepare for that and train your employees and your vendors for that, or oversee them for that. What do you do if you're a sort of a smaller kind of regional bank that doesn't really, you know, they may get one or two here and there? How do you protect yourself against these kinds of issues? Any thoughts on that, Tyler?
Well, again, you know, you've got to be tuned into the areas where you're located, of course. If you're smaller and more centralized, then it might be a little bit easier. But, you know, you have to be involved. You have to be in various REO working groups I'm part of. So getting different, you know, email subscriptions and that sort of thing, just to get a heads up of what's out there. There's obviously a number of prop preservation vendors as well that will handle that work for you and kind of take some of the risk out of that as well.
And Brian, as a sort of an outsourced vendor, what do you recommend from an institutional perspective around this issue when they may not see, you know, 10, 20 properties, but they may see one or two once in a while? How do they stay on top of these issues?
I think the most important thing there is to make sure that the folks that you're leveraging in local markets to be your eyes and ears, primarily listing brokers, are very, very aware of local ordinances, local requirements, local property registration rules, and the like. You know, whether you're a large institution or small, quite frankly, it's very challenging today to stay on top of every single rule in every single jurisdiction that affects the holding of an REO. And so I think that making sure that institutions are engaged with vendors, with providers that are very, very familiar with local rules and have demonstrated their competency and understanding in those local rules and ordinances is just critical. So I think screening brokers, making sure that brokers have been well-trained, and making sure that they really are representative of the local communities in which they work is probably the most significant effort that an institution can undertake.
Right. Let me shift to the next question. This is something that I know community groups are very concerned about, the sort of the vacant properties that really prolong the recovery cycle, as well as sort of neighborhood deterioration. Are there any best practices when it comes to dealing with those properties? What are institutions doing to ensure that properties don't stay vacant for extended period of time, that it doesn't lead to a place of criminal activities and other things that creates the downward spiral that many communities are facing today? If I may just start with PJ, any thoughts on that? How I know you've taken some aggressive actions in the various different markets. Any good examples that you can share with everyone?
Yeah, just I'll briefly probably reiterate what I mentioned earlier about our four field service companies and the fact that we've really ramped up over the past couple of years the amount of audits that we do. So we send our internal folks out. We also send an external vendor out to check on the work of both our brokers and property preservation companies. So that's good to do from an all property perspective. The other place where we've been very aggressive is, to your point, a lot of, especially the low value properties that are vacant, they don't get better with age. And so what we see is one of the more responsible things that we can do is we market all properties in a retail basis, so they are open to all buyers, you know, the typical broker and sign on the front yard. But we don't allow extended marketing periods for the low-value properties, and we'll get into it a little bit later as we touch the sales portion, but we think that the, you know, moving those types of properties to qualified investors that we have an ability to track and monitor afterwards is the most responsible thing to do, because those buyers are the ones that are going to move these properties back most quickly to productive use, either through rental or resale.
Great. Tyler, what is Wells Fargo PAS doing in this regard around vacant properties and deterioration of neighborhoods?
Well, similar to what PJ just touched on, the first option that we're going to look at is the low value assets. We've got a couple different options for those. The first, of course, being donations. We're doing we've got a new network of nonprofit organizations that have been vetted by the Wells Fargo Housing Foundation, so they qualify for REO donations. Once we donate the property to them, we know, as PJ mentioned, they're going to turn that back into a viable property to help stabilize that community. If the property is not eligible for donation, it will be eligible for first look, and we're going to touch on that later. I know, but again, that's another method to get these properties immediately to nonprofit organizations on a discounted sale. So that's all done, all considered before the property is ever listed. If it passes through those, it's not eligible for donation, it's not purchased in our first look period, then we're going to consider repairs. We touched on that a little bit before as well, and we're certainly expanding the scope of our repairs on our REO inventory, knowing that it has a drastic effect on our hold times. We know that the longer a property sits out there, the more it depreciates, the more likely it is to get broken into. There's just a bigger risk. So if we can do necessary repairs, again, we're not looking to get a dollar-for-dollar return on the expenditures, but we know if we cut that marketing hold time in half, that we're more than going to make up that cost.
Okay. Well, so you do have a sense that by making those repairs, overseeing the properties effectively, that and shortening the marketing period, that actually you do get back portion of the investment that you put in repairs. You feel that's consistently the case?
Yes. Yeah. We're consistently looking at that, and that's part of the decision that we make when we determine if we're going to do or what scope of repairs we're going to do to a property. We know what our daily holding costs are per property on average, and we know how much quicker we're going to sell a property that's repaired in a certain MSA versus if we try to sell it as is and distressed. So all of those things factor into the decision. We can make a mathematical choice that actually also benefits the neighborhood and the stabilization efforts.
Right. It's always great when those things align together, so that sounds great. If I may shift gears a little bit in terms of property preservation, maintenance, and oversight issue. I know we touched on this briefly early on. We've heard a lot of discussion about oversight of third-party vendors in the servicing arena, but more recently around the REO side of the business as well. The sense among few folks out there is that the oversight is sort of inconsistent. There's some times there's some spottiness to how we manage vendors. There seems to be a lack of industry standard around, you know, what we view as matrix that we want to measure people against. I know institutions like Fannie Mae and Wells Fargo and others take these responsibilities very seriously because it has a broader institutional reputational issues. Do you get a sense? That this oversight is actually improving in the industry? And if not, what can institutions do to make sure these risks are minimized on a go-forward basis? And if you can all kind of respond to it, and also in the context of smaller financial institutions that may not have hundreds of people in their operation who can help with the oversight, how do they deal with it? So if I may just start with PJ, I know you obviously have a lot of huge inventory that you're overseeing and managing, both in-house and as in using outsourced vendors. How do you manage the volume as well as sort of the complexity of the properties and situations in different markets?
So I think I'd start with just mentioning that a few years ago, obviously, we knew it was coming at us, and so we ramped up our internal staffing. So that allowed us to build the infrastructure and the processes and quality controls that are critical to ensuring that we can manage our vendors. And as you mentioned, we do outsource about 30% of our sales function. We outsource all of our property preservation function to about 4 vendors. The repairs are outsourced through a network as well, and then our broker. The brokers are obviously external to the company. So I'd say probably the most important item is our REO sales guide, which is, I think, a 300-plus page quick read. But that's our effort to make sure that all of our processes and everything we expect of our vendors is very transparent. It's out there available to all of them, and we reissue it several times a year to make sure it's up to date. But like I said, it's really about the complementary internal staffing to make sure that you can manage your vendors, that the vendors know how they're being scored, and communicating that consistently with vendors to manage things very timely, I'd say.
Thank you. If I may now turn to Brian, as someone who runs an outsource company, one of the third parties, if you will, how do you both ensure compliance with your clients' demands and needs and requirements, as well as having to deal with other third-party vendors that you're having to manage on their behalf? Any thoughts on how to provide some adequate controls around that, as well as some best practices you have seen in the market? And again, kind of talk about it within the context of some of the, for the smaller institutions, how do they go about ensuring compliance control through the process?
Sure. Again, I think for small institutions and large institutions, there has been such a focus on oversight and compliance as the market has continued to struggle that there's a whole cottage industry that sort of cropped up around the issue of inspections. So there are abundant third-party inspection firms that will go out into the marketplace and review the condition of properties, review the marketability of properties and the like, and report that information back to institutions so that they can engage in some decisioning around those results. I think if I have a significant concern with respect to where we've moved in terms of compliance, it is that I think right now the industry is at a point of sort of form over substance. So your point, Jim, in the question about is there a matrix that the industry has agreed to, and is that matrix used consistently with respect to the assessment of property condition, at the end of the day, what lenders are interested in knowing is this property presenting well to the market in its current condition? And if not, what are the things that need to be done, either to ensure that the property isn't cited for code violations or other types of fines, or is improved with respect to its physical presentation to potential home buyers? So the industry, unfortunately, right now, I think, is characterized by a checklist mentality. And so we have one matrix after another. You're right, there isn't consistency, but there are a lot of them, really looking for things like, are the utilities on, is there a sign on, and so on. And I think the problem that we're concerned about with respect to owner occupancy is that home buyers don't approach properties and assess their purchase based on the absence of defects. They're really looking for the presence of attributes that really make houses homes. I think that's one of the disconnects that exists with respect to the information being reported back to institutions that they in turn can decision around, and that is, are there qualitative dimensions with respect to this house that can be imparted to these institutions so that they can try to do a better job of driving good sales outcomes? And I think right now we're fine with respect to compliance in terms of checklists. They're out there and they're well used. But I think taking the compliance and assessment to the next level, where we're really assessing whether or not we're presenting properties well to potential owner-occupant buyers, is an area of defect and absence right now.
Thanks, Brian. Tyler, from your point of view, are there sort of adequate controls around third-party vendors? If so, what are some of the best practices you have seen in to ensure that you get the kind of outcome you want as an institution from the vendors that you're utilizing in the market?
I think it's certainly up to the individual service provider to determine how they're going to oversee their third-party vendors. I think similar to what PJ was talking about, you know, we have a agent scorecard. They agree to a code of ethics and business conduct when they agree to do business with us. And they know that that is a monthly report and that any occurrences can negatively affect that scorecard. And we recently enlisted secret shopper programs. We're consistently doing property inspections unannounced in really all the major markets that we're in. We'll send teams of asset managers, teams of the management team, even, you know, ground bank team members will enlist to go out and check out how properties are being preserved, how they're being maintained. If there's an issue, the agents know if there's an issue, it's going to get back to us. That will negatively affect their scorecard and their ability to do business with us. So above all, they know that they need to protect, if they want to stay on as Premier Asset Services agents, that they need to take care of our properties just like they would any of their other retail customers. And really, that's what we're looking for. We talked about code violations and prop pres and everything else, and all that factors into it. But basically, we want that property to present as if a homeowner was selling it. If we don't want it to stick out on the block as an REO property. And they know that, and they're expected to make sure that's how that property presents. And if it doesn't, that goes on their scorecard, and eventually that will get them removed from the network.
Thank you for that. And I'm assuming that's the case both at Fannie Mae and I know as New Vista, everyone is kind of scorecarding or reviewing the performance of brokers as well as other vendors, and we need to make sure that that their folks are meeting those requirements. If not, they're being removed. And I see more and more of that in the marketplace. And I think overall that's a positive trend towards more accountability in terms of folks we hire. So that's great. Let me one more question on the sort of the property preservation repair strategy section. And I think one of the positive outcomes of the NSP program is that it created sort of a collaboration at the community, nonprofit, government level, as well as servicers that own REO assets. If I could ask Eves about this, NCST has been really the hub of this effort. You have brought nonprofits and other buyers in front of many servicers that want to support and participate in this program. What kind of, as you provide the adequate transfer of assets to these to the nonprofits and cities, proper maintenance of REOs are they pursuing once they get the properties? I mean, many of these institutions and nonprofits, some of them have not done REO acquisitions in the past. What are they doing to ensure that they are taking the properties, fixing it up in the right way, and getting it ready for sale into the community?
With the creation of NSP, all of our buyers know what the expected mandate is from them. That's basically to acquire the properties, do the rehab. The rehab that they're engaged in, it's not the cosmetic rehab, but true rehab, whether it's a significant or a gut rehab. The outcome is to save more properties and make them buyer ready, so whenever someone purchases a property, they don't have to spend money on doing the rehab, but rather it's in ready to move in condition. I think the key success of our buyers is that they're local. Real estate is and continues to be a very local effort, and so they're engaged with the community. So they're going to actually do the rehab consistent with the neighborhood and not go out and try and do something that may be very avant-garde or very retro, but whatever fits within the existing communities. I mean, and the best outcome would be to get the properties before they get to REO, but when they do come to REO, the buyers are really looking and getting the properties and having buyers ready to buy those units. Looking at the comprehensive cost of doing the rehab and then budgeting it in so there's not any surprises. The servicers, they stand to save money by really working with our buyers because as we go in and do the comprehensive rehab, we're not just rehabbing one property. Our buyers like to say that they're buying one property, but by engaging in that necessary rehab of that one structure, it's saving the financial institution money because they're going to ensure that that house comes back to value, and it may actually keep another person from doing a strategic default or walking away from the property because that property has been really ignored for quite some time. So they're really doing that comprehensive rehab that's bringing value back to the property. At times that rehab may exceed the necessary cost, but they're willing to take the hit and just make sure that whatever work that they do, they'll make it attractive and the buyers will really be getting a property that's in excellent condition and no surprises. I think some learned from Katrina when they gave the money directly to the consumers and the consumers were responsible for doing the rehab, and we saw that didn't necessarily work to the expectation. So this way, it really works well, and the communities at large are very successful in getting a large number of properties, and they're bringing them back to reasonable, habitable conditions.
Great. Thank you for your great work on that regard as well. Let me shift now to the REO sales discussion, if I may. I know repair and maintenance strategy and sales strategy, we have separated this in terms of the presentation, but we know they are very much linked. They're very much connected in terms of the ability to push sales, to get it to the right buyer, and your repair strategy. Let me talk specifically now at this next section about so your sales strategy, what you're doing out in the marketplace. I know the institutions have deployed many different ways of selling REOs, whether it's traditional use of realtors, listings, bulk sales to investors, auctions, online sales, and many other initiatives that have hit the market. From a consumer and community perspective, I may just ask a few of you to talk about what the benefits or some of the concerns associated with each of these disposition channels may be and what institutions should be thinking about in terms of trying to create the best outcome, best result at the neighborhood levels. And finally, if we can just talk a little bit about the impact of these initiatives on owner occupancy in communities, that would be great. So with that, let me first start with Brian Hurley from New Vista, just talking about owner occupancy issues and these sort of various different channels of selling REO assets.
Sure. I think today, Jim, most institutions are leveraging a variety of channels to dispose of REO. Some of the other panelists spoke about challenges around low-value properties and the like. And so I think there are several challenges at the disposal of institutions, and I think most are leveraging all of them. I think from a community standpoint, though, the biggest distinction in terms of impact from the choice of one channel over another really does come down to owner occupancy. I shared at the beginning of my comments that at New Vista, we've actually been tracking owner occupancy and REO disposition since the first quarter of 2009 in 21 of the hardest hit markets in the country, and owner occupancy rates on REOs are in fact falling. And communities obviously have justifiable concerns around that because of long-term correlations between owner occupancy rates and other positive things like, you know, low crime rates and educational attainment and the like. The problem I think that institutions face is that, you know, there is a clear institutionalized preference in the world of REO sales for investor transactions. And last 4 quarters, we've actually seen the percentage of all cash owner-occupant buyers increase, but owner-occupants are still more than 3 times as likely to use a mortgage in the purchase of a home. And the leveraging of a mortgage in today's mortgage market for an REO acquisition just creates all kinds of delays. You know, whether as a result of kind of extreme regulatory reactions to the mortgage market that was, or a lack of competition in mortgage origination, mortgages just take a lot of time to process now. And that really results in 2 additional risks for REO sellers. One is that the transactions themselves may fall out simply because they're more risky since there's a mortgage involved. But the other secondary risk is that because those transactions take longer to close, the reality is that you have longer periods of holding an REO, which exposes them to longer periods of time for fines and fees and vandalism and crime. And so I think that from a community standpoint, the most important channel with respect to REO disposition is a channel that does more than just create equal access for owner-occupants. It actually somehow institutionalizes or rebalances the institutional preference for owner-occupants so that more and more home buyers end up acquiring the properties in these hard-hit communities.
Thank you. Since you brought up the First Look kind of initiative to drive at least a temporary preference to owner-occupants, I know Fannie Mae has been one of the leaders in that regard for a long, long time. PJ, if I may ask you, I mean, what kind of results have you seen in that First Look program? I know you have done other things to drive owner occupancy into the marketplace as an institution. Can you kind of talk about what you've done, what's worked well, and what has not, if I may?
Sure. Right, and I think Brian did a great job with that question. But what we did was create First Look. We actually rolled it out in Cleveland in April of 2008, and that was primarily a response to some nonprofits that felt like they weren't getting a fair seat at the table. And so the way we responded there was to say that, we created First Look before it necessarily had the tag First Look. And so we offered the first 15 days of marketing for the exclusive offer of those nonprofits as well as owner-occupants. And we saw that the nonprofits and owner-occupants were probably much more likely, I guess, to see successful offers in those properties. To Brian's point, certainly when you bring government subsidy, that sort of thing, mortgages to the table, it makes the transaction more tricky. But I think what we've been able to accomplish with First Look is it actually has helped us change the culture of not only our internal organization but the broker network that we have to manage to do this. And so it has very clearly stated our preference. We rolled out First Look nationally in August of 2009, and so it's very clearly stated our preference for owner occupancy and for nonprofit buyers or public buyer, publicly funded buyers to be buyers of our property. And we think that those are the most likely to stabilize the neighborhood with immediate occupancy and quality rehab, as well as the fact that, as I think Brian mentioned earlier, they pay more. An owner-occupant is willing to pay what that house is worth to them and not calculating a yield based on whatever their offer is. So it's really the best of both worlds, and I agree that in the beginning it may have been just to level the playing field, but what it's really been for us, First Look, has been a tool that has really changed the culture of the way we do this. So in addition to First Look, I would state we've also had a very firm focus on our sales to those public, we call them public entities, NSP, if you're familiar with the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, HUD, $7 billion, funded basically government organizations, and as that funding trickled down to either nonprofits or land banks, we consider all those buyers to be public entities, and so we've really gone out of our way to incorporate those groups as buyers into our First Look programs. We've created exclusive First Looks even prior to the traditional marketing to offer those buyers our sales, and we've seen great results with, I think in our First Look sales alone to owner-occupants, we've sold over 50,000 homes just in the first 15 days of marketing to owner-occupants. Just to give you the frame of reference, about 60%+ of our sales are to owner-occupants in general throughout the marketing period. We've sold over 8,000 homes to NSP recipients or other publicly funded buyers, so we've been very successful in that space. But just to answer the full question, we do sell in bulk. We do sell at auction as well. But again, this is after, bulk and auctions don't take place until after the property's been marketed for quite some time in a retail market. And bulk and auction are really our ways of transitioning properties that are aged or otherwise impaired back to the market more quickly, so that, as we referenced earlier, that you don't have properties kind of stagnating and becoming issues unoccupied in the neighborhood.
Great. Well, those are great initiatives. Tyler, if I may ask, I know you also have, Wells Fargo PAS has put forth a lot of efforts to reach out to owner-occupants as well, but some people suggest that, you know, there aren't owner-occupants aren't out there really buying. It's really the investors that have the demand. Do you see that to be the case in the marketplace, that really there isn't a demand at an owner-occupant level for acquiring these assets, or is that just a misconception in the marketplace?
Well, it's a little bit of a misconception, I would say. If you're willing to do the work to the property, to the asset, do some repairs so that an owner-occupant can move into that property and it's habitable from closing on without them having to do repairs or remodel, extensive remodeling themselves, then, yeah, those buyers are out there. We're certainly seeing, you know, with our new repair initiative, we're fixing up more and more houses, and we're seeing, if not an increase, at least a steady number of owner-occupants purchasing properties in neighborhoods where previously it was the majority were going to investors. So, yeah, we're seeing that as another benefit of doing the repairs. We're holding them for less time. We're selling them to owner-occupants, and as mentioned, they're far more likely to secure a mortgage on a property, and we are a mortgage lender, so that's another benefit for us. Not to mention, when we do a repair to a property, we know that it's likely that we're going to have a property near that in REO sometime soon, so that could be our comp. So if we spend $10,000 on a repair and we get $8,000 back, we didn't leave $2,000 in that property. We were able to secure a mortgage. We were able to get an owner-occupant into the property. And next time we go to use that property as a comp, it's $8,000 higher than it would have been if we hadn't done the repairs. So there's certainly a market out there. You just have to do a little bit more legwork to get those properties ready for them.
Now, do you find that you have to get the property to essentially FHA lending standard? Because my sense is that most of the owner-occupant purchasers in the market related to REOs are mostly getting FHA financing. Is that usually the kind of the critical benchmark that institutions on the call should think about as they get their property ready or repaired to a certain standard?
Yeah, that's kind of the basic benchmark that we strive for. But if we see other issues with the property, more major issues, structural, for example, then we'll reach out to our rehab financing folks, our 203K people, and put some of that marketing in the property so that and really educate our agents on that available financing. So, yeah, the property may look like this, but you're buying it at a discount, and here's what you can get, you know, for the sum of your monies with the rehab loan. So it takes a little bit more education of the agents, of the buyers, and, again, utilizing the rehab dollars that are out there.
Okay, great. My next question goes to all four of the panelists. I know there, and PJ, I think you talked about the bulk sale execution. Obviously, it's not typically the major execution path for most institutions, but it is being widely discussed in the market, and people have been chasing after these elusive bulk deals that are sitting out there. What kind of screens, if you're going to do bulk sales because you know, the retail channel didn't work in terms of the moving the properties through, if you're going to do that, what kind of screens and oversight do you do to ensure that you have responsible investors on the other end taking acquisition or purchasing these properties, number one? And also, what we have more recently seen is some added activities around trustee sales, which seems to be accelerating in the marketplace for institutions to sort of not put all of their, or a huge chunk of their properties under a foreclosure path. Do you have concerns about that strategy, and what can we do to ensure that we get the right outcome at the community level in that regard. Let me first start with Eve, if I may, from NCST. In your view, is that a big concern, or should we focus on other things?
It is a concern. Bulk sales does not necessarily exclude nonprofit buyers and just go to investors. We have some buyers that crave the ability to purchase the bulk. Now, it may not be the traditional bulk definition of 100 units or more, but maybe smaller pool of bulks, because it makes sense for them, because they can really buy more properties at one time, so they can have economies of scale, they can employ more people at the same time, and not have to continue doing this purchase of scattered site infill housing. So our buyers are very much interested in doing it. The challenge is finding a way where they can get a bulk sale that works for them, because unlike the investors that can take an all-or-none approach, they have to be a little bit more particular in the properties that they can take, because their intention is, I'm going to rehab every single one of these properties. I'm not going to cherry pick the good ones and then get rid of the bad ones to another sale.
Brian, what's your thoughts on this? Both the bulk trustee sale and another path that's been being utilized more aggressively nowadays, or seems to be more aggressively utilized, to reduce the number of property flow into the foreclosure path.
Right. I think that, you know, we found recently that some lenders are really leveraging sales at foreclosure. And by trustee sales, you're really referring to a situation where the lender doesn't bid the entire amount of their unpaid principal balance at the foreclosure sale. They just let the property go at the foreclosure sale itself to the highest bidder. You know, we're focused very, very closely on owner-occupancy execution in this channel. And obviously, you know, for a purchaser to have the level of sophistication, and obviously to have the all-cash purchase price ready to be able to purchase a property at a trustee sale, I think really excludes owner-occupants from that forum. And so we're obviously concerned about the impact of that trend with regard to owner-occupancy rates. But at a community level, I think that there's another concern that local governments are likely to have as well. You know, when you have an institution like Fannie Mae or like Wells Fargo take a property back through foreclosure, it's relatively easy for that community to find them. So when you have property registration ordinances and property repair concerns or other types of remediations that are necessary, you have institutions like Wells and Fannie stepping up to the plate, taking responsibility and trying to do the right thing. On the other hand, in a foreclosure sale where someone comes in with all cash and takes title of the property in the name of XYZ Partners LLC, that's a very difficult entity to find. It becomes much more challenging for communities to try to identify who's responsible for that property at that time. And so I think just from a pure cost of enforcement and ordinance standpoint, communities are going to end up being challenged by this emerging trend as they try to deal with some of the challenges that they've already pretty much squared away with regard to major institutional acquirers, now that we see many more of these foreclosure sales ending up in small private investor hands.
Thank you. If I could just shift the question just a tiny bit. There seems to be a lot of discussion today, Treasury, RFI, around the rental strategy, kind of bulk selling a deal to investor large buyers to turn it into rentals and so on. If I may ask both PJ and Tyler about this, how do we ensure, as people think about selling these bulk of REOs to various institutions to do, in many ways, something, maybe it could be for a good thing or not, how do we ensure that we partner up with the right people on the other end to get the kind of outcomes we all desire at a community level, market recovery, price stability, and all those good things that we all support? PJ?
Sure. So maybe it would help me to be able to start with the background on kind of how we've been doing pool sales. I said bulk earlier. We typically call them pool sales because our attorneys prefer that. But we've been doing pool sales since beginning of 2009, and the way we've gotten comfortable with it is because we have been, as you mentioned, vetting our buyers. And I don't want to lead anyone to believe that there's some thousand investor list out there that we're dealing with. It's really not that large because we've had so many folks that just haven't met our criteria. And so what we do is we want to understand the entity that's going to take title, and we want to understand who the principals of that entity are. We run background checks on those folks. We require the submission of experience, business model, and we kind of get a general level of comfort with what is the strategy and where are these folks focused. Once you've done that, I'd say by and large the vast majority of interest kind of falls out, and you wind up with kind of the real players that are left. And so in addition to that, contractually, when you buy in a pool from Fannie Mae, you're also required to you have resale restrictions that require sales, a certain level of sales to owner occupants, and a certain holding period for all properties, so that we're not just selling to flippers. Obviously, if we do so, we're leaving money on the table, and it doesn't do anybody any good for us to sell to folks that aren't willing to reinvest in properties. So there's a requirement for our investors that buy from us to report on a quarterly basis as to what they've done with the properties. We audit those. What is self-reported by the investors, and so we feel very comfortable. I think what Brian was alluding to is you have a lot of investors out there that have decided what a great time to buy, and they're not necessarily ready to, and so that those investors become code issues for communities and just general issues for communities, and we don't deny that. And so we've been very candid about who we've been dealing with, very open with community organizations about who we've been dealing with, and we're more than happy to stop working with somebody, because we've had community organizations report to us that certain investors, not necessarily that we've sold to, have been active in their market, and they're not paying taxes and therefore letting properties go into tax foreclosure. And we've immediately removed those investors from our lists. And in one case, we had an investor that went to a community organization and said, you know, we've really redone the business model. We've been operating like this. And that community group came back to us and said, we'd like you to start working with, you know, XYZ again, because we think that they would be good help and scale to offer our community. And so it's been really a collaborative effort, I'd say, at our level, and just being transparent and willing to work with the community organizations. So we've seen, again, the pool sales it's by no means is it a large scale volume. Retail's always been and always will be our primary disposition strategy, but it's certainly been a good help to us in the low value range.
Okay, well, thank you for that response, and I also want to apologize to your attorneys about misstating.
No, I started it.
Tyler, from your perspective, I don't know how much, I'm not quite sure how much bulk or pool sales you're involved with, but are you also kind of looking at, given this whole discussion that's happening right now about rental strategy and selling these the REO inventory into a rental strategy format, have you thought about that, and does that make sense, you think, from a community perspective?
Well, we certainly looked at it, because that seems to be the winds that are blowing right now. As far as bulk, let me start there real quick. I am allowed to say bulk, so that's good.
You're going to confuse everyone on this call, by the way.
The only bulk sales that we're actively engaging in right now are on lot loans. We've certainly heard the community concerns about selling in bulk sales, and it certainly makes sense with the way that we have to do our bulk sales. We're a little bit different than Fannie in that we don't own the majority of the properties that we're servicing. So if we do a bulk sale, when we were doing bulk sales, it was not geographically centered. So you weren't getting 50 or 100 properties in Cleveland. You were getting 2 in Cleveland, 2 in Florida, 5 in California. And these were all properties that had been listed on the retail market, reduced or looked at every 30 days. And after 120, 150 days of not selling, then we'd be put into a bulk sale, which is obviously going to be bought by an investor, and likely an out-of-state investor for the majority of those properties. Well, having heard those concerns, we certainly understand that you know, that's tough to oversee those investors and follow up and see exactly what they're doing with those properties. So we've kind of backed off of that strategy, and now we are only doing lot loans, only feel the risk there is far less than if there's a structure on the property. As far as rental, it's interesting. It seems like only a year or two ago, when the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act came out, that there was this great concern about landlords. And even now, when we sell to investors, they tend to get painted with the same brush, and they're all negative. Communities are screaming, "No, we don't want you to sell to investors." We're implementing First Look. We've got a homeowner priority period that gives priority to homeowners before investors. And now we're being asked to come up with a strategy to sell to those same investors that we've tried to freeze out. So, you know, wrapping our head around that is a challenge. But at the same time, we're certainly open to the idea. We're not necessarily open to the idea of us holding the properties and renting them back. That's not our business model. Is it similar to everyone else on this call, I'm sure. Vetting of the investors, I think, would be incredibly important. If we get, independent third party, maybe that's a role that the NCST plays in vetting investors that are eligible to purchase properties in bulk, then that would be something that we would certainly look at.
Okay. Thank you, Tyler. Well, since Tyler gave NCSCT potentially a new business line, any thoughts on that, Eves, on being the vetter of potential acquirers of these assets for rental purposes?
That'll be fine, because we're always trying to find creative usage, and we already go through a vetting process anyway with our buyers. We have mostly nonprofits, but we do have a for-profit development programs where we go through a very exhaustive vetting test whenever we get an inquiry from a for-profit developer that's interested in doing community revitalization. We place them in touch with the local housing effort, once again referencing that housing is a local initiative. So we place them with the local groups. We make sure that they're in concert with whatever the locality is trying to do, and that they end up being more of a capital infrastructure in working at the local effort. So that's something consistent with what we've been trying to do, so we'll be more than happy to get engaged. And that's not just for Wells, it's for all the other servicers involved. Thanks, Tyler.
Well, let me ask Brian on this one, just to kind of wrap up the rental discussion. Does that make sense in all markets, in your perspective?
Well, I think from a community perspective, Jim, the worst thing for a community with respect to an REO is vacancy. So, you know, vacancy leads to increased rates of crime, vandalism, and the like. So, you know, where you have a particular community where the alternative to rental is a vacant house, I think that institutions have to have some kind of rental strategy to address that. But, you know, wide-scale programs that try to move a significant supply of housing stock into rental programs are really sort of a supply-side intervention in the market, and they seem to be a capitulation to the view that there just aren't enough buyers out there in the marketplace. And it strikes us that in a period of time when housing has almost never been more affordable, both as a result of prices and as a result of mortgage interest rates, that before we get to that stage, we really need to make sure that we've explored every option for home buyers to actually acquire these houses. And I think that our biggest concern when we look out at wide-scale rental programs and other types of supply-side interventions is that when we engage with our broker network, the folks who list and sell these REO properties on our behalf in markets throughout the United States, we hear over and over again that they're working with dozens of buyers who don't have opportunities to purchase properties because of that institutional predisposition to work with investors that I referenced. And so they make bid after bid after bid after bid for houses, and they never seem to end up being successful. And I think that, you know, before we engage in a large-scale move that diminishes the available supply of REO properties for potential home buyers, I think we really need to fully examine the demand side of the equation to make sure that as an industry and as a market, we're doing everything we can to let home buyers, potential home buyers, take advantage of the opportunities that's in front of them.
Thank you, Brian. I think this was a terrific discussion today. I do for the last hour now, I do want to turn it over to the Federal Reserve team to ask some specific CRA-related questions, tenant protection issues as well. But I think the dialogue has been fabulous and terrific. Thank you for your insight. And now let me turn it over to Joseph and have him take on a couple of questions and also ask some of the questions that the listeners might have related to the various topics that we just discussed. With that, Joseph,
thanks
take
so
it away.
Thanks, Jim, and thank you to all our panelists for sharing their perspectives. So I'm going to ask a few questions that we've received from as people are sending them in over the instant message or whatever. So so the first couple questions I get, I'm actually going to direct to Barb at the Cleveland Fed, and they relate to CRA. And the question is, I've heard that there has recently been a rule change to CRA that would give CRA consideration for institutions that undertake certain neighborhood stabilization activities that are consistent with HUD-agreed plans under the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. Does this apply to donation of REO properties, and what are the key things that, I should know about the rule, and where could I get more information?
Sure. Thanks, Joseph. As I'm sure you're aware and everyone else on the call is aware, under the Community Reinvestment Act, an institution is evaluated primarily on how well it helps meet the credit and community development needs of its CRA assessment areas, including low and moderate income neighborhoods consistent with safe and sound banking operations. In December of 2009, the federal regulatory agencies announced changes to the Community Reinvestment Act to support stabilization of communities affected by high foreclosure levels. And this change became effective on January 19th of this year. The final rule encourages depository institutions to support eligible development activities in areas designated under the Neighborhood Stabilization Program that's administered by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The expected benefits of the NSP is to stabilize property values and prevent neighborhood blight. And some eligible activities under the Neighborhood Stabilization Program include the purchase and rehabilitation of abandoned and foreclosed homes to sell, rent, or redevelop, to establish and operate land banks for foreclosed homes and residential properties, demolished and blighted structures, as well as development of demolished and vacant properties. Also, a financial institution would receive favorable CRA consideration for donations of REO property to nonprofit housing organizations in eligible middle-income geographies, which is up to the 120% median family income, as well as the low and moderate income geographies. And consideration would be given to institutions whose activities are outside of the financial institution's assessment area, as long as the institution has adequately addressed the community development needs within the assessment area. Now, these types of donations for these properties, if a bank is evaluated under the large bank test, where you have the lending, the investment, and the service test, this type of credit would go to the investment test. And then if you're an intermediate small bank where you have the lending test and the community development test, this type of credit would be given under the community development test. And more information can be found in the Federal Register that is dated December 20th, 2010, which you, from what I understand, if you just Google the Federal Register with December 20th, 2010 date, that register should come up. And, of course, I would think that if you had any other questions regarding REO properties for the Neighborhood Stabilization Program, that you should be able to contact your primary regulator.
Great. Thanks, Barb. That was great. One other question that I have that I think I want to direct to you before I turn it back to Jim and the rest of the panel with some of the others. This question was relating to tenants, and it says, we are interested in the pitfalls regarding tenant rights for properties we are foreclosing on or properties we are auctioning off. And we have properties originated in our own portfolio and properties we acquired, and we are preparing for an examination. What should we be aware of in terms of tenant rights in that situation?
Sure. To give a little bit of background on the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure Act of 2009, it requires that tenants residing in foreclosed residential properties be provided notice to vacate at least 90 days in advance of the day by which the property must be vacated, therefore giving adequate time for tenants to find alternative housing. Except, however, when the purchaser will be occupying the property as the primary residence, then the term of the bona fide lease also remains in effect. The initial sunset date for the Protecting Tenants at Foreclosure was through December 31st of 2012. However, the Dodd-Frank Act extends this protection through the end of 2014. So institutions are expected to have policies and procedures in place to comply with this law and other consumer regulations. And the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve put out a CA letter, which is CA letter 09-5 from July 30th of 2009, that provides background information on this act and what is expected to comply. But some of the things to kind of give you a little overview of what the examiners look at when they do come on site is that the primary objective is to assess the institution's awareness of the responsibility of the act, to assess the compliance management policies and procedures within the respective responsibilities under the law, as far and also ensuring that routine reviews for compliance of the law are incorporated into the compliance monitoring program. We also looked to determine that the internal audit program was updated to include the audit plans in evaluating this. And also, we also look to see if any customers of the bank have been foreclosed, and that we take a look at the file, ensuring that proper adherence to the law was applied. So basically, to sum up what the examination process would consider is the institutional awareness, policies and procedures, training, compliance monitoring, and audit.
Great. Thanks, Barb. The next question I have, I'm going to direct to Jim Park, and Jim, maybe you can direct this to the appropriate person, either Eves or somebody. But the question is, if a community has a problem with the servicer's maintenance of its REO properties, is there a number to call, or who should they call? And, you know, basically, what's the procedure for sharing that information with the either the servicer or the owner of the REO property?
Sure. I'll, you know, since you mentioned Eves, we'll start with that. But my guess is that both Fannie Mae as well as Wells Fargo and others have call-in numbers that they can describe. So let me, Eves, you want to take that on first?
Sure. I was actually going to say call you, but because of our role as a national intermediary, if anyone in any community throughout the country having access issues in contacting servicer, they can be more than happy to contact us, and we'll get in touch with the appropriate personnel. But I do know a lot of the other financial institutions, they do have readily available numbers to contact them and to provide them with alert status if there's any issues going on with their properties, and they can better inform you about those.
Well, Eves, my phone number happens to be the exact same number that you have, so it's by coincidence. Let me turn it over to PJ and Fannie Mae. If people are having issues at the local level with one of your properties, who should they call?
Our number is 1-800, the number 7, Fannie, F-A-N-N-I-E. It's the same one I shared earlier. So, and we love to hear from people. You know, we're not. It's not an. It's good for us to know that our property has an issue. We want to address it, and so we certainly encourage that.
Tyler, do you have a similar number or a place to reach out to?
Yeah, I would recommend going to sending an email to codeviolations@wellsfargo.com. Just all one word.
Great. Thank you.
And Brian, I know you have a number of other clients that you service. Do they, most of the clients you have, do they have a call-in number such as this or a website for the most part?
Yes. In fact, one of the most common ordinances that REO holders have to comply with is a property posting ordinance. So one of the things that we inspect with respect to all the properties we have in our portfolio is to make sure that there is a posting on the property that alerts people as to how they can get a hold of a variety of parties in the case of escalation. The broker, us as the and the lender.
Great. Joseph?
Yep, so I got a couple questions that, PJ, maybe you could take a crack at, but others may have suggestions too. To the extent that you're able to share, you mentioned a 300-page REO guidebook, and you also mentioned some of the practices that you guys employ in terms of ensuring that the investors that you deal with on pool sales are, you know, have met certain standards. Is there any information that you're able to share with, you know, with people on, you know, that are part of this call about, you know, that they could replicate in their own programs? Is there publications or is there anything on the website? That's the general question a few people have asked about.
That's a good question. I can't say positively what we would be willing to share, but we would certainly be happy to look at that and get back with the Federal Reserve to say to distribute that that kind of guidance.
How about Tyler? You also have a pretty extensive guide, statement of work of your outsourcers and everything else.
Yeah, there is some information on our website, which is reo.wellsfargo.com, which has some frequently asked questions regarding, you know, property preservation, working with us, and some of the expectations that we have of our vendors and our agent network. So some of that's out there, and really all the public information that we have is available on the website.
Actually, if I could say the same, that's a good point, Tyler. Our website is HomePath, HomePath.com. It has all of our properties listed. It also does have FAQs and ways for different real estate professionals to get in touch with us. But I don't believe that our REO sales guide is a public document. So we'll have to look at that further.
I think we have time for maybe one or two last questions, so I'm just going to give them both to you, Jim, and then you can decide where to allocate them. The
all
first
right.
question is... there's been some talk about working with land banks to dispose low-value properties. So the question is, has anybody had any success with that, and what are sort of the things to think about? And then the second question was, where do we find the list of geographies designated for NSP, or the Neighborhood Stabilization Program? I'm not sure if that's something Eves might know, but, again, I'll leave it to you, Jim, to figure out who wants to take either of those two, and then we can turn it back to Tracy after that.
Well, I think the question about NSP, I think the expert is Eve, so let me turn it to you. Are there some master directory or anything that people could be guided towards related to the eligible geographic areas for NSP?
With NSP, the recipients, they really actually were the ones to draw the areas, especially in round two. Round one was really a non-competitive grant based on simply the foreclosure scorecards. Anyone that's wishing additional information, they can go ahead and contact me, and I'll give them the data for the respective area. My contact number is 214-710-3408.
Great. Let me take the question about the land bank and really direct it to, I think both Fannie Mae and Wells Fargo, PAS, have been supporting community groups around this. So let me ask them to cover that. Land banks, what kind of work do you do with community groups around that? What kind of issues and concerns have you seen? And is it working in certain communities? Let me just start with PJ.
Sure, thanks. We've found great success with land banks. I want to highlight one thing that I think is important is that land banks are a new entity, and they're great entities, but they don't exist everywhere today, and so I don't want people to, it's kind of a buzzword in my mind at this point. I don't want people to, that's kind of the end-all, be-all of where you kind of work with governments. So as I mentioned earlier, we've sold about 8,000 properties to NSP recipients. 450 or so of those have been to one land bank, and that's Cuyahoga County in Cleveland, where we've had a fairly groundbreaking model. But we've worked with about 15 land banks nationally. Primarily they're in Michigan and Ohio to date, but we worked with the St. Louis, Atlanta land banks. So they're popping up everywhere, and states like New York have recently passed legislation. But I'd highlight that over 1,500 of our 8,000 properties have been sold to actual government entities, so the city of Akron, Ohio, or the city of St. Louis. So city and county government entities have actually been purchasing property as well, so I don't want people to exclusively look at land banks. And then obviously the difference is really the nonprofits that have picked up the public funding. So I think land banks will become more and more prevalent, and they're great entities to work with. We've had a lot of success, but don't just look there.
Great. Tyler?
Yeah, we've had a great relationship with Cuyahoga County Land Bank as well, and with a number of other land banks across country, and I would echo PJ's sentiments. When we have a property that's eligible for donation, the first thing that we do is offer it to our nonprofit partners. As I mentioned, we've got a group of nonprofits that have been vetted and approved by our housing foundation to receive REO donations. Now, we clear title on these. All liens are paid. There's no outstanding water debt. So it's just like a regular REO transaction. They're getting clear and marketable title to do with the property as they please when we donate a property. We've done over 800 of them already this year. We're going to do over 1,000 of them by the end of the year. And a portion of those do go to the land bank. So if we offer, for example, a property in Cleveland to all our Cleveland area nonprofits and they turn it down, that's when we will offer it to the Cuyahoga County Land Bank. The land bank is primarily there to demo properties, and we have an understanding with them, not an agreement, but just an understanding that when we do offer property to them, we will also contribute towards demolition costs. That contribution depends on the investor that actually owns that property. And also depends on the location of the property. If it's in an NSP area that we just talked about, then we'll contribute $3,500 as long as the investor allows us. If it's outside of the NSP area, again, if we're allowed, we'll contribute up to $7,500 towards demolition costs. So we've done, I think, this year about 28 donations to the Cuyahoga Land Bank along with I want to say over $150,000 in contributions towards demolition. So it is a viable disposition strategy. It sounds a little scary at first. We're giving a property away along with, you know, $7,500. But you have to consider the market that it's in. We weren't able to give that property away to a nonprofit organization for free. So no one is even willing to take that property. We know the condition that it must be in the marketplace of the community. So that's how we're able to justify the cash contribution along with the REO donation.
Great. I think we're almost out of time, so let me do this. Let me first of all thank our panel, and also as I turn it back to Tracy, just make sure that you're aware that the last slide has a number of additional resources that you could go to, including that Governor Betsy Duke speech that I mentioned at the very beginning. But, Tracy, I'm going to turn it over to you so you can wrap and we can stay within our time.
Great. Thanks, Joseph. So that does conclude our event today. I, too, would like to thank all of our presenters. I think we were really fortunate to get their perspective on a range of issues associated with REO properties, and we truly hope you found the presentation useful. As soon as the presentation ends and you exit the main menu, there's going to be a short feedback form that will appear on your screen. If you have your pop-up blocker set, it might not come up, and you can then go to the survey tab before exiting the main menu in order to access the feedback form. And we would really appreciate it if you could take just a couple minutes to let us know what you liked about the presentation, give us any suggestions for improvements and possible topics for future calls. Your feedback is very important to us, not only on ways we can improve these events, but also on other ways in which we can have productive dialogue with the industry. So, thank you again for joining us today, and that does conclude our call. Please look for additional announcements on future events. Thank you.